Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Ryan Bailey, and today we're talking Champions League. The final is set, guys and gals, and we'll also be taking a look at the CONCACAF edition. The final is not set of that. More on that later. Joining me today is the XGOG, the statistic mystic, the formation sensation. He's the Captain America that always plays the full 90, Joe Lowry.
Ooh, that was a fantastic intro, as always, but also maybe a little shot at Christian Pulisic for not getting on the field for the full 90. Mr. Bailey trying to sow trouble here.
I feel like more of a shot at Tuchel than Pulisic.
fair.
More on Pulisic, the other Captain America number two, as we call him around these parts, Joe, very shortly. But joining Joe and I is a man who's felt right at home watching games in the snow and hail in May. It's Scotland's Graham Rubin. Hello, Graham.
The sad thing about that is it's completely true. It's been snowing today where I am, and that is just tragic. Absolutely tragic.
Now, I haven't lived in the UK for quite a while, Graham, but that's not typical, is it, in May?
Not in May. That is unusual. That is notable. People have mentioned it this week. You know, if it had been January or February or whatever, then it wouldn't even have been in discussions. But yes, it has been mentioned. Slightly unusual.
Yeah. Thanks, Al Gore. Anyway, I guess, Graham, you're reveling in the prospect of an all-English Champions League final as a Scot.
Almost as much as Florentino Perez is.
Oh God! You two doing a podcast after this one, I imagine.
Yeah. Me and Florentino, we go way back. We're tight.
Well, we are guaranteed an all-English Champions League final, of course, with Chelsea. They'll be taking on Manchester City after their respective semi-finals. We're going to be talking about both of those semi-final second legs very shortly. We're also guaranteed an American is going to win the Champions League, the aforementioned Christian Pulisic or Manchester City's Zach Steffen. I wonder who'll get more minutes in that game, Joe.
Yeah, you kind of buried the lead there, Ryan, leading with the whole all-English Champions League final, blah, blah, blah. I think you meant to start with Christian Pulisic versus Zach Steffen, but it's early. We'll let it slide.
I was building to the crescendo of that, Joe. That's what
fine,
I was doing.
Fine.
That wasn't bearing the lead.
I'll go with you on that one. I'll go with you.
Well, it's an all-English final, just like it was 2008, wasn't it, when we had a team from Manchester playing Chelsea as well. I think Chelsea would be hoping for a different outcome in this one. As you remember, I was in Bangkok watching that game. I was on vacation at the time. I think it was like a 2 or 3 a.m. kickoff. It was a very surreal way to watch a Champions League final. So my question to you two, and I hope this reaps interesting results, is where is the most interesting place you have watched a Champions League final? Joe, I will go to you first on this one.
I watched a Champions League final in Mexico City not too long ago, and that was
nice.
Really fun. I wasn't able to go out and watch. This was before COVID, so I could have, but I was there traveling with my family, and so I wasn't able to go out and watch with a bunch of other soccer fans. But still, watching the game and hearing other folks around actually enjoying the game as well was pretty darn fun. Maybe not as fun as Bangkok, but still good.
Bangkok's fun and different ways to Mexico City, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Was it quite a big draw there, that game?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big game in a big soccer area. It was fun to go around the day leading up to the game as well and seeing all these different people getting ready for the game. It was a good time, Ryan.
Oh, good time. Well, unlike the good time or the lack of good time that a certain MLS team had down in that part of the world this week, we'll talk about that one a little later on. How about you, Graham? What's the most interesting place you've watched a final?
Portland, the 2019 Champions League final, which I know maybe to stateside listeners is maybe not that interesting, particularly if they live in Portland. But, you know, Portland like to lean into the whole weird thing, don't they? Keep Portland weird.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah,
oh, yeah,
that's an interesting place.
Yeah, that is interesting. The weather not too dissimilar to what you're accustomed to as well.
It was actually scorching weather. It was a real trip to be told so many times to expect Scottish weather in Portland and then have to roll up my jeans as I was walking around Portland because it was so hot. Yeah, that was weird.
Oh, so you're the one who started that trend. Got it.
I was just following everyone else. That's what everyone else seemed to be doing, the rolled up jeans in Portland. I didn't have time to grow a beard though in like the 3 days I was there. Well, I mean, I haven't grown one yet in 29 years, so growing one in three days was probably going to be beyond me.
You got the dig in before I could. Oh, bless you, Graham. All right, well, let's talk about Chelsea against Real Madrid. This one finishing 2-0 on the night. 3-1 to Chelsea on aggregate. A pretty well-deserved win for Chelsea, this was, Joe. This is history for Chelsea. They've already got one Champions League final in the books with their women's team facing Barcelona a week on Sunday. This was their eighth semi-final, their third one in which they've been successful. Possibly, I'm going to have to look at how many semi-finals they've played against teams in black socks, because Real Madrid, that was what they were wearing for this one. But I think if I was a Chelsea fan tonight, Joe, I would have been having near cardiac arrests for at least most of the first half, just thinking, we should have buried this game so many times, and there's a chance that, you know, they're going to get an equaliser and Sergio Ramos is going to poop house a winner here and we're going to be out of this thing. What did you think of Chelsea and the chances that could have haunted them potentially?
There were chances that could have haunted them, and that is certainly one way to look at it and a valid way to look at it. But you can flip it around a little bit and say, wow, Chelsea created enough chances to win this game. And they do get that second goal later on in the second half, thanks to Mason Mount and maybe to a lesser extent, Christian Pulisic. But I thought this game from Chelsea was phenomenal. I thought they came in with a strong game plan on the attacking side and on the defensive side. They came out and tried to expose Real Madrid's narrow midfield shape. Madrid was in that, you know, 5-3-2 shape, or at times looked like a 5-2-3 shape defensively, and Chelsea came prepared to switch the ball side to side to pull center backs out of position, and Real Madrid just couldn't cope. And then defensively, Chelsea were compact. They stayed solid. They didn't have to be the protagonists in this game because of how the first leg went. I thought Chelsea had the best performance of any of the games that we're going to talk about today, and I think they 100% deserve to win this game and this tie.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree that. I think it was something we've seen a lot from Chelsea lately, Graham, is that they don't concede chances very easily. And it seemed like Real Madrid were just struggling to get anything together in the attacking half at all. And that might be an indictment of the quality of Real Madrid tonight. We can get to that shortly. But full credit to Chelsea for the way they set up. And it's, as I say, quite similar to what they've done before. But one thing I noticed, Graham, was Madrid had a lot of possession, particularly in the first half, but just didn't do anything with it. It was Chelsea, despite having less possession, who always seemed in control. They were completely controlling the game. They were controlling the spaces. And when they did have the ball, they were brilliant of getting the players into the right spaces at the right time. I'm calling them the Space Masters, Graham.
Or there's got to be a German word for that. You know, like what do they call Thomas Müller again?
The Raumdeuters.
Yeah, there's got to be some German term for what Chelsea are. Tuchel probably has come up with one. Yeah, I think it was what we've come to expect from Chelsea, and I mean that as a compliment and not to change the focus in any way, but in some ways it was similar to the performance from City the night before when they allowed PSG to have a lot of the ball, but you never really felt like City were out of control. Similar sort of thing from Chelsea. I mean, over the two legs, Real Madrid only had two shots inside the box. Daniel Story was tweeting earlier that under Tuchel, Chelsea have kept 18 clean sheets in 25 matches, which is five more than they managed in all of last season under Frank Lampard. I mean, he's maybe the only Chelsea fan who didn't have a good night tonight as poor Frank Lampard. Wow, what a difference this team is. And yeah, where could they have been if Tuchel had been in from the start? Could they have mounted a title challenge? I don't think that's completely ridiculous to suggest that, given how well they have done since Tuchel has come in. And yeah, as you say, I never felt like, I get what you're saying with the nervy ending, but that only really came from Chelsea missing chances rather than anything I saw from Real Madrid. And we all know that unwritten soccer rule that if you miss chances, the other team's going to score one. But beyond that unwritten rule, there wasn't really any tangible evidence that Real Madrid were actually going to conjure up anything. I felt Chelsea were secure throughout this whole match, even before they got that second goal.
You've got stronger nerves than me and a lot of Chelsea fans, I imagine, then, Graham. But yeah, I get what you're saying. There wasn't a sense that it would have been a bit of a travesty if Real Madrid have got anything out of this. Such was Chelsea's strength and Real Madrid's relative poorness. And you touch on Thomas Tuchel there and the job he's done. Joe, can you go a little bit more into what he did here and what he did right? I mean, as Graham was saying, it's been 100 days, only 100 days that Tuchel's been in charge. He's got them to a Champions League final, his second consecutive one, FA Cup final as well, from ninth place to fourth in the Champions League. You know, and all those clean sheets that Graham was talking about as well. Quite incredible stuff. He's baking with the same ingredients as Lampard, but he's making a different cake.
Yeah, he is. He really is. Tuchel's come in and done a lot of good things. Early on in his tenure, at least as far as I can remember now, with Chelsea, it was a lot of possession, like dominant possession, but not a lot of chance creation. And now, even just looking at this game, we see Chelsea being able to create chances, not just with possession, which they did, but also using their defensive block to then draw the other team forward and attack into space. Tuchel hasn't done a lot, and maybe this is exposing myself as a fraud here and unable to analyze things, but I don't think Tuchel's done a ton of mind-blowing stuff. Chelsea's possession shape in most games is just a 3-2-5, just pushing the wingbacks high, and then they can slide back into the back line when they're defending. It's pretty logical as far as I can see it, but they're executing very well. They're coming in with detailed, smaller game plans for each individual opponent against Real Madrid. I mentioned it earlier, but one of the things that Chelsea had success with in the first leg and how Christian Pulisic scored that goal is by drawing the center backs out for Real Madrid, because Real Madrid like to defend in that man-to-man style along the back line, at least for certain moments. They did that again in this game. It wasn't Christian Pulisic that reaped the benefits, but on the first goal, Timo Werner, that move from Conte and Havertz and Werner pulling those center backs out. Not so much Havertz, but you get the idea. Chelsea had an idea of how they wanted to break down Real Madrid, and they executed it really, really well. Tuchel has got this team playing fantastic soccer. I don't know how far that'll carry them against Man City in the final, but they are playing very well right now, and again, they deserve to win this game.
They are playing very well, but I think, Graham, something we've touched on before on the weekend review, and maybe something you have opinions about, is Chelsea, I think the word I've used is they're very professional. And maybe that is a euphemism for boring, Graham.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, to be honest, tonight is an exception to that. I thought Chelsea were in an attacking sense, were very good, and that's reflected in there. I don't know if you've seen the open play XG from this game. So Chelsea were 3.76 and Real Madrid was 0.52. That's a big yikes from me, the difference between those two, and reflects what was in nature, I think, a pretty attacking performance from Chelsea, the number of chances that they created, we've referenced a number of times already. So this was a little bit of an exception. I enjoyed them watching them play more than I normally do. But yes, you're right. I think, generally speaking, I don't look forward to their games under Tuchel. Thomas Tuchel probably doesn't care about whether I look forward to their games. But yeah, I'm just saying it how it is. I don't look forward to their games much. They are a little bit conservative for my liking, but highly, highly effective. I do think one player, and this isn't a revelation, I think this is quite clear from the performance tonight, was I just wonder how much better a true goal scorer makes Chelsea. I think I might have mentioned this in one of the Champions League reviews after the game against Porto, the second leg, where it just fit that game felt like a game where if Chelsea had a true number nine, they take one of their chances and they're out of there without the nervous finale. Again, tonight, if they have someone, a fox in the box, you know, to use that old cliche, to stick away one of those chances, they're out of there by 60 minutes, maybe even by halftime. And I just think you add a player like that to Tuchel's team, and that's the thing that could take them to the next level. I like Timo Werner, but I think I like him better kind of in a wide position than through the middle. But yeah, that was one of the thoughts I had tonight, was just reiterating how much I think they need one of those players.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And Werner, of course, making way for Captain America number two, Joe, when he did come on Pulisic, it seemed like for at least the first 5 minutes, he had about 80% of the ball. he was also sort of kind of struggling to find the right pass. I think a little bit later on, he dragged a shot wide. So I'd like to get your thoughts on him and maybe some of the other attacking players. Like Kai Havertz, for example. He was really entertaining tonight. Obviously had a loving relationship with the woodwork tonight in this game. And I was struck by his aerial prowess in this one as well. And his playmaking, the way he was dropping to receive the ball a lot. He was particularly impressive, I thought, Joe.
I'll start with Havertz so I can crescendo to Pulisic, as you've taught me to do, Mr. Bailey. Havertz, I thought I thought was good. He did have those couple of chances, and he did have a loving relationship with the woodwork. I'm still trying to figure out where I stand on this whole, do Chelsea need a classic number nine, or can they continue to roll with the three more flexible attackers in this game? It's Havertz, Werner, and Mason Mount, and they can all kind of rotate into different spaces. I think Havertz is a good fit in a lot of senses for a game against Real Madrid where, as I mentioned, you want to pull those center backs out. If you have a Giroud, or if you had, you know, a more classic goal scorer in Icardi, like we saw for PSG, I'm not sure that you get that same level of movement to drag the defenders out and then expose them in behind. But again, different types of players are useful in different moments, even within different possessions. And so it is hard for me to draw those lines. But I thought Havertz did a lot of good things in this game, as did Timo Werner, as did Mason Mount, and as did Captain America number two, Christian Pulisic. He comes on for Timo Werner in the 67th minute, and he mishits a couple passes. He doesn't immediately settle in, but he is immediately dangerous when he comes on to the field. He comes on, and he toasts Militao to drive the ball forward on Chelsea's right side, Real Madrid's left side. He draws a yellow card from Toni Kroos, has a couple of really nice bits of combination play to pull Real Madrid defenders out, continuing that theme on. He creates some danger in the box, drags that shot wide, and then gets the assist for Mason Mount's goal, again being dangerous in the box and being patient in the box in that moment as well. Christian Pulisic comes off the bench, and you can sort of understand why Tuchel has him coming off the bench, because he really is that classic FIFA sweaty super sub coming onto the field and using his speed, using his technical ability to create chances, and those chances paid off for Chelsea in this game.
They did indeed, and it was quite a good weapon to have a good change of pace to have Pulisic coming on, particularly when you look at Real Madrid and they have Mariano as their option to bring on in a similar way. So in that perspective, it's pretty good from Chelsea there. I think we should also give the obligatory praise to N'Golo Kanté as well, who does seem to do everything. He almost seems like he's an optical illusion, but I think it's because of his size. He can change direction so quickly. I don't know if he moves as quickly as we think he does, just because of the mechanics of his movement. I'm working on that conspiracy theory as we speak. But on Real Madrid there, Graham, it did seem quite disappointing from them, as we've said. My long-standing theory that Toni Kroos has a bad game and so do Real Madrid, he was very poor. He was quite poor in the first leg of this encounter, to be fair. But he was doing more of the cynical, trying to scythe people down. I think he tried to take Pulisic down when he came on as well. Was it Mason Mount? I think he did the same thing too in the first leg. I forget now. But he just seemed to be slowing stuff down. And it seemed like he was pretty ineffective, as were much of the midfield.
Yep. And I, midway through the second half, I did have a wee think to myself and thought, the Ryan Bailey theory is holding up once again, where Toni Kroos is having a bad game and so are Real Madrid. Just going back to that Kanté moment when for the first goal where he jinks through the Real Madrid midfield before setting up Havertz for his alley-oop off the crossbar. It was a moment that made me go, wow, Real Madrid are old. I don't know if anyone else had that feeling where it was like watching someone who was, I know N'Golo Kanté isn't exactly young himself, but it was like watching someone who was 10 years younger play right through Real Madrid. And it does really feel like this Real Madrid team are at the end of a bit of a cycle now. They've tried to eke out as much as possible from a lot of these legends, genuine legends. This season kind of feels like the end of a cycle. Having said that, I do think injuries need to be taken into account tonight for Real Madrid. Sergio Ramos and Hazard were in the team, but only really in body, not in spirit. They had no fit right back. They were playing Vinicius at right back because Carvajal's been injured for the rest of the season again, and Vasquez is out injured, and Zidane doesn't trust Odriozola despite paying 35 billion euros for him. Varane was out injured. Valverde was only just back from self-isolation. I actually think he probably would have played at right back. It is a position he's played before. He played in the right side in the Clásico, albeit not at right back, but he was in a defensive role and a right midfielder in the Clásico. I think he would have played if he'd been fit. When you take that many key players out of the equation, it was always going to be difficult for Real Madrid. And I think this is a big summer for them. Having said that, I'm not sure what to expect from Real Madrid this summer, because they're laden with debt and it doesn't really seem like they're going to do much business. So it might be more of the same next season.
They'll just be savouring their two-year UEFA ban, which is the current update on what's coming to Real Madrid. So we'll certainly see, Graham. And you make a good point about maybe we're in transition with this team, that's for sure. Joe, can you tell us a little bit about what Real Madrid did with their setup? I'm intrigued, as Graham mentioned it, with Vinicius going right wing back, which seemed to limit his attacking opportunities somewhat, had to get back and cover. And then was it Asensio, I think, came in? And then Asensio switched flanks when Rodrigo came in. And that Rodrigo coming in seemed to be a bit of a gamble to take Casemiro out and put him on. What was Zidane trying to do here exactly?
Now, that is a good question. We got to see Vinny, a.k.a. Italian mobster slash Brazilian playmaker, dribbler, play as a right wing back, which is a weird choice. But I think Graham detailed why that happened really well with all the injuries that Real Madrid are dealing with right now. Zidane, in possession, set this team up in a flexible 3-5-2. I'm kind of waving my hands around fluidly as I'm talking right now. You guys can't see, and listeners can't see either. But it's so fluid with how they possess. A lot of times it's Toni Kroos dropping into the back line in between two of the three center backs and then splitting the outside center backs wider and making it almost into a 4-4-2 at that point. Then you've got Nacho as a left back high up the field, or you've got Militao as a right back high up the field. And it does look a little bit strange at times, but the idea behind it is to get Kroos or Modric, he did a lot of this as well, deeper on the ball to then pass the ball into the attack and progress from there. But they didn't have a lot of success doing that. Hazard and Benzema didn't find the ball in good spaces between the lines, at least not that I can remember. And Chelsea did a good job of pressuring Real Madrid and specifically pressuring those playmakers just like they did in the first leg of this tie. So they didn't have a lot of success breaking down Chelsea. Again, it's hard to break down a block. Chelsea didn't have to be the protagonists in this game, even from the start of this match. So they could sit deeper and force Madrid to break them down. Benzema had a few quality chances, but beyond that, they didn't have much. And then defensively, I've already detailed the struggles that the center backs had because of the game plan. And the other thing is that narrow midfield that I touched on in my kind of my opening comments here. You've got Modric, you've got Casemiro, you've got Kroos, and I agree with you, Graham. It looks like they're old, trying to shift side to side. And then you add the fact that they have to cover for Vinny, who's not a right wing back. He's a right winger or a left winger or something in the attack. Then they have to do even more running, which they were incapable of doing. Over and over again, Chelsea had the ball on one side, switched it over to the other side, attacked into space. Had the ball on one side, switched it. You get the idea. Real Madrid had a game plan. It just didn't work.
No, it certainly didn't. It certainly didn't. But before we move on from this game, gents, I wanted to give credit to both the goalkeeper, because goalkeepers both seem to have a pretty outstanding game. Mondi in the first half was almost a man in the match contender. I think Peter Schmeichel on the CBS coverage was praising his efforts there, and the way he was commanding his defense and stuff and saying what a good goalkeeper he is. And also Courtois very much keeping the contest alive with some massive saves in the second half. I don't feel like we give quite, or in general, we don't give enough credit to goalkeepers, but this one seemed like the scoreline was very much kept down by both, Graham.
Yeah, absolutely. And if Chelsea had had Kepa and goals, Real Madrid would have been 3 up by halftime. Yeah, Courtois, I'm glad you mentioned Courtois there, because it's really strange for a player who is one of the most expensive goalkeepers of all time, who plays for Real Madrid. I still feel like Courtois doesn't get the credit he deserves. I know he's widely regarded as one of the best goalkeepers, but for me this season, he's probably been the best goalkeeper in Europe. I watch Real Madrid every single week for my job, and he, initially, he was obviously very shaky at Real Madrid, and even last season there were a couple mistakes. I can't think really of a big error he's made this season. Maybe there is one, but he's been really solid for Real Madrid all through the season, and we saw that tonight, because this would have been an absolute thumping if it hadn't been for some of the saves that he made.
Absolutely. One last word on Eden Hazard. Graham, I think you had some comments about his performance in this one. And also, we need to touch on the fact that he was basically celebrating with Chelsea players at the end. I don't know if you saw that.
I did see that. And I'm not one of these old men who likes footballers. You know how you see people complaining on a footballer posts something to Instagram after a game and people complain, why are you not, you know, in a deep dark room thinking about what you've done? I'm not usually one of those people. Having said that, if I was a Real Madrid fan watching Hazard at the end of that match, that would maybe get to me a little bit, just a little bit over the top. I actually forgot he was playing until about 30 minutes in, which is strange, because I felt before kickoff he was one of the things that might just get Real Madrid through. He started against Osasuna on Saturday and had a really good first half and gave Real Madrid something they'd lacked recently, just a bit of drive, a bit of energy, a bit of link-up play, and I thought that could be a deciding factor for Real Madrid if they're going to get through this game. But he just offered nothing at all in this match.
Yeah, big shame. Well, with him not getting a lot of game time, well, certainly he's coming back into action. And Sergio Ramos, I think it's 7 weeks since he last played for Real Madrid. And this whole team being held together by electrical tape, apparently. Maybe it's no surprise that Real Madrid did not go through and Chelsea did. And you mentioned players who should be sitting in a dark room thinking about what they did. More on that after the break when we talk about Paris Saint-Germain.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Well, luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Total Soccer Show, we are back. Let's talk about the other semi-final second leg. Manchester City versus Paris Saint-Germain. This one also finishing 2-0 to the English side. 4-1 on aggregate to Manchester City. Snow in Manchester, Graham, as I mentioned at the top of the show. I did not see that one coming. By the way, does the Champions League have like an orange or a yellow ball? Because it seemed like at times that would have been appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, the one time, how many times do you see them use the fluorescent ball and think, ah, it's not really needed today? This was the one time. This was the one time we wanted that ball and they didn't have it. I was actually getting, because the way it was, I think it was actually hail, but because it was lying on the pitch, it was giving me sore eyes. watching the match, but yeah, maybe not as sore eyes as Mauricio Pochettino had at the end of this match, having watched this team slump.
That's right, sore eyes all over in the Paris Saint-Germain dressing room, I imagine. Why don't we start with Paris Saint-Germain first then? Joe, Mbappe not making a meaningful impact on this game, quite literally. Would he have made a difference to what went on with Paris Saint-Germain here?
Yes. Oh, yes. Ryan, thank you for lobbing the softball my direction right off the top. I genuinely appreciate that. I think losing Mbappe hurt. Man, this sounds so obvious, and I'm not trying to just state the obvious here. Losing Mbappe hurts. Not having Mbappe hurts. He provides so much to PSG when they counterattack, number one, but also in possession. And I think they really missed having someone who will make active runs in behind to create a little bit of space for Neymar or to create a little bit of space for Verratti on that left side, which is where PSG, I think, did the majority of their possessing. They missed that nine who's going to create space, and Icardi just doesn't do that. He makes runs in the box. He creates separation for himself in those areas. But if you can't get into those areas, it doesn't really matter a whole lot, does it? So when Mbappe's out dealing with this injury, Pochettino decides he's not ready to play. PSG lose a lot. They lose in transition. They lose in possession. And they end up losing this game. Maybe not specifically because of that, but I think that's certainly one of the factors here.
Yeah, definitely so. And I saw a lot of people criticizing Icardi for sort of not getting off touches, but that's not kind of the, as you say, it's not kind of the player he is. He's one of those get in the spaces at the right moment kind of players. But also in the front line, Graham, Neymar, who didn't have a classic Neymar performance. Well, he did in some ways. He went down screaming unnecessarily a few times. But his selfishness, I thought, really came to the fore on a few occasions here. There was some time, I think there was a chance in the second half where he had the opportunity to lay off to a very wide open Mauro Icardi and decided to press on and go it alone. And I think there was more than once where that happened and he thought, come on.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Yeah. This was the game that Neymar has been waiting for and probably the kind of thing that he envisaged when he moved to PSG. He obviously thought he was going to be the main man at PSG, stepping out of Messi's shadow, and then obviously Mbappe emerges. But as we've mentioned already, Mbappe's watching from the bench for this game, so it was all on his shoulders. And I had a misguided feeling before this match that Neymar was going to produce the performance to define his whole time at PSG.
Well, he did actually.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. This was a complete reflection of what his time at PSG and the number of dribbles into blind alleys. And yeah, it felt quite selfish at times. And to be honest, and I wrote a piece about this today, Neymar's a brilliant player, but it's getting to the point where I do wonder whether PSG would be better off just moving him on. If he wants to leave, then leave. He's on 37 million euros a year salary. And that money could probably be well spent on some fullbacks, I'd imagine, is probably an area of that PSG team that could use a little bit of money, I would say.
Yeah. Oh, Florenzi's fun. I'll give him that. But Joe, let's talk about PSG and how they're setting up here. You know, obviously the 4-3-3, and we know what Poch is about, but it seemed like they were trying to put bodies forward in the second half, and they were trying to go for it a bit more, and it just gave City more and more opportunities to counter against them. And as that went on, they were kind of losing it emotionally. The ill discipline cost them in both legs, obviously with the red card for Di Maria in this one as well, for a very, very unnecessary challenge. But what do you think went wrong for a Poch team here? And we can use the cliche about, you know, a Poch team getting a bit Spursy towards the end of things. But if you can be a bit more technical than that.
I'll happily try. PSG, just like Real Madrid, had to be the protagonists. The English teams didn't have to because of how they set themselves up in the first legs of these two semifinals. And so Man City come out and play this. I know you asked about PSG. I'll get there. Don't worry. Man City come out and play this 4-4-2, and it looks like Atletico Madrid. They're sitting a little bit deeper and compressing space really well, which then forces PSG to take the ball, move it, and break them down. And PSG did well, I think, in certain moments of this game, in progressing the ball, breaking through City's press, which they did press at times, and then using Paredes and Verratti and Neymar to progress the ball into the final third or into the attacking half. That all went well for stretches. But then in the final third, they lacked the ability to create space. And part of that is because City defended so narrow, the logical space is out wide. But as Graham mentioned, the fullbacks, I didn't think were up to the pace in this game either. Diallo on the left and Florenzi on the right. Neither one of them had a major impact in this game, even though that's where the space was. And I think PSG needed those players to have bigger games because everything was so compressed, so packed in, so tight in the middle. The space is out wide, and PSG either were unwilling to use that space or were incapable of effectively using that space in possession. And I think as a result of that, they didn't create a lot of chances with the ball in this game.
Yeah, I think the headline here, perhaps, gents, is the City were just very cohesive, and not, I don't want to use the word professional again, but they were well-disciplined, whereas Paris Saint-Germain just seemed a bit untamed and pretty ill-disciplined, particularly when things started unraveling for them. But, you know, Pep Guardiola is often accused of overthinking these games. Sometimes he underthinks them. Graham, what was the over-under on the thinking here from Pep? Because it seemed like it was just everything just went right for them in this one.
Yeah, I don't think Pep was up through the night thinking about this one, and that's a good thing. I think, you know, Pep's partner needs to, before big Champions League nights, needs to tuck him in bed before, you know, the early hours to stop him overthinking his strategy, because this just felt like what we've seen from City all through the season. Having said that, on the defensive side of the ball, it was something slightly different. And I do think Guardiola's shown that he's learned from past Champions League failures when City were a bit too open. He wasn't afraid to set up his team here to sit quite deep and absorb and deny PSG that space in behind. That's kind of how they handled PSG's threat, which albeit was blunted a little bit with having Mbappe on the bench. But out of possession, there was a good Michael Cox article about this in The Athletic. They seemed to be set up in a 4-4-2 shape with Bernardo and Kevin De Bruyne as the front two, which is not terribly orthodox, but I know they've played a strikerless system a lot this season, but to have a 4-4-2 shape like that with those two as the front two is not terribly orthodox for a Pep team. And the midfield four was kind of used to determine how high their press was. So all four midfielders were in sync, which just was, again, key to restricting PSG and having any kind of space to run into and behind or even through the centre of midfield. So, it was, I think I saw someone describing it as a typically Pep performance with a little taste of Atletico Madrid, which I thought was a pretty good description.
That is a pretty good description. And your description of Pep being tucked in at night by his wife, by the way, that's sending my mind racing. I just imagine he doesn't sleep. He just sort of crouches on his haunches next to a whiteboard and goes into low energy mode for a few hours. That's how I imagine his nights go by.
I just imagine he sleeps in that giant cardigan that he wore for, I mean, better than any duvet, that is.
I bet he's got a hammock version. He's got a hammock version at the City training ground. That's what he does. Anyway, less of that. Joe, we should talk about City's defense. defending, because it seemed to, their proper defending was the key to this. Even, you know, behaving themselves from set pieces, which may have let them down. I think Marquinhos had a decent chance again from a set piece in this game. But Ruben Dias, obviously incredible, blocking every single shot that Paris Saint-Germain could put on the net. And in the show notes, Joe, you wanted to pour some praise on Ederson, who was quite good in this game, and particularly by setting up the first goal, completely cutting out PSG, half their team, bypassing them and setting up Zinchenko to put the run in for that goal.
Yeah, the individual performances from City in within the defensive structure, I think, were very good. You mentioned Ruben Dias there. He was everywhere. Graham, I saw you wrote a piece about him, talking about his defensive exploits in this game, blocking shots, doing all the defensive things. Credit to John Stones as well, and really that entire back line, Zinchenko and Kyle Walker as well, for making moves defensively. They did really well back there. And then, yeah, Ederson, that ball on the first goal for Manchester City was just unreal. So City have the ball in their own half. They play it back to Ederson, who then just pings this ball over the top to Zinchenko. It looks a little bit rehearsed. It looks like Zinchenko's high, waiting for that ball. He beats PSG's offside trap, and he's also within his own half as Ederson plays the ball over the top. So it wouldn't even have mattered if he'd been onside, because he's still in his own half, so he would have been anyway. Zinchenko gets that ball out of the air from Ederson. He keeps running, gets it down, and then pulls it back to De Bruyne. It's a deflected shot from De Bruyne that falls, fortunately, to Riyad Mahrez. But that goal just... it doesn't happen without Ederson. It doesn't happen without that, the style of goalkeeper that's kind of the pinnacle of what Pep is trying to do. That style of goalkeeper can be useful defensively and can step high and make tackles, you know, closer to midfield than you would expect, can save shots, and then can also play out of the back to start counterattacks, to just keep possessions moving. Ederson is just such an important piece of this Man City team, and that's been talked about plenty. But not as much recently, just because that the trend and the excitement of, oh, these goalkeepers are now doing things with their feet, that's kind of died down because it's normal now. But credit to Ederson for doing what he's done for quite some time and having it be in such a big moment.
Yeah, definitely. I just couldn't get the mechanics of that pass, because he's gained so much distance on it. It was like nearly three quarters of the field. It barely looked like he was swinging for the ball. And to get that much accuracy and that much power, I can't understand how he does it. Well done to him there. But you mentioned how great that goal was, Joe. The second goal as well. A sublime counterattack it was. Another Riyad Mahrez goal this was, with sort of Kevin De Bruyne and Foden doing a really nice 1-2 and De Bruyne putting a really perfectly weighted pass into Foden's path. Another perfectly weighted cross comes across for Mahrez, almost the archetype Man City goal there. But you can't help but notice that Angel Di Maria just jogging. Diallo, just jogging. No one's really bothered about this counterattack that's happening. So I think in some ways it was sublime from City, but also PSG brought it on themselves a bit, Joe.
Yeah, this is the classic things can be two things kind of goal, kind of moment. Man City's counter is so fast. From the moment that Fernandinho clears the ball, I think it's off of a PSG set piece, and Fernandinho clears the ball, and this is before City have even settled it and actually gotten themselves on the ball and moving towards goal. But from the second the ball hits Fernandinho's foot, it's 15 seconds to when the ball is in the back of the net off of Riyad Mahrez's shot. And so the ball's got to come down out of the air, then they've got to move the ball 80 yards forward. It's ridiculously fast, and City are so good at moving the ball quickly. We talk about tiki-taka and possession, and they do those things very well also, but they move the ball at pace better than almost any team in the world. Pep's teams have always done that, at least as far back as I can recall. But then, yeah, you have the issues with PSG defending this goal as well. They don't have a lot, especially without Idrissa Gueye in this game. They don't have a lot of guys who do a ton of defensive work. It's pretty much just Herrera in midfield, and then it's Paredes and Verratti, who are more passengers defensively than they are actually going to drive the bus or drive anything in that space. And so, yeah, then you have Angel Di Maria and you have Neymar, and you just don't have a ton of players who are going to track back and do that job. And I'm not sure, even if they had, that it would have mattered because of how good City are at moving the ball forward. But you can't look at this PSG squad and say that defensive transition moments aren't a weakness for them at times.
Yeah, a big Gallic shrug is what this PSG team were essentially in this game. Graham, Riyad Mahrez, we should probably shine some light on him as well. I think I read in The Guardian he had 43 touches in the first half alone. He had four tackles and interceptions as well. He was very, very good in this game. And a point that I think Ed Ahrens made on from The Guardian on Twitter is that Mahrez and Kante, both going into the Champions League final, Leicester bought both of those for £6 million. And it says a lot about how far they've come. And I think there's been some write-ups of Mahrez and, you know, coming to Leicester as a championship player. And look where he is now. Quite superb.
Yes, you beat me to it with the Leicester City mention there, that whoever spotted them for Leicester City has had a good week or a good couple of weeks, because you could argue that Mahrez and Kante were the best players in both legs that they played. There was a Riyad Mahrez video that went viral today, where he was talking about the opportunity he had to sign for St Mirren in Scotland. But in his words, Scotland was, quote, cold and terrible. So
is he wrong?
on the terrible bit, yes. No, I'm only kidding. Yeah, Mahrez definitely flies under the radar a little bit, doesn't he? Which is insane, considering he's a £60 million player who's won the Premier League and has also been PFA Players Player of the Year. but yeah, he had a really good game here, and it feels like he's just kind of squeezed out Sterling as Pep's favoured option to provide some width. I know he cuts inside a lot, but he is the one who provides a little bit of width. And I also enjoyed him winding up some of the PSG players, who obviously they completely imploded after 60 minutes, which was essentially a rage quit from PSG. I've been there, where you just think, ah, this is completely done. Ander Herrera as well, not just Di Maria, Ander Herrera getting involved. I saw someone describing him as a plastic poop house. You don't totally believe it, you know, even though if he's got the whole act, he's up in your face, but you're not really that scared. It's a little bit like, you know, that film, what's it called? The one with Seth Rogen, I think it's called maybe This Is the End, where Michael Cera plays a badass in it, but you don't really... Yeah, that's Ander Herrera, basically, in this game. He's Michael Cera playing a badass in this game, trying to pretend he's a poop house, but he's not really.
In his Ray-Bans, trying to look all cool.
Sorry, yeah, that was the most rambly point ever. You started off asking me about Mahrez, and now I'm on to how Ander Herrera is Michael Cera.
That's why we're here, Graham. It's why you get the big bucks. Don't worry about it. But you asked her, by the way, who found Mahrez and Kante. I believe that was the scout Steve Walsh, who is now scouting for Charlotte FC. Look out, Major League Soccer, in 2022, is all I have to say on that matter. So we do, gents, have two English teams in the final, as we've established. Joe, what do you think about that? Is that an indictment on the teams on the continent necessarily? Is it deserved that the English teams have made it this far? Because there was a point, you know, 12 or 13 years ago, where it was almost a given that you get several English teams in the semi-finals, and when you got an all-English final, it was like, yeah, fair enough, because the Premier League's the strongest. Is that fair right now? Is the Premier League head and shoulders above? Is it warranted, Joe?
I think this is not an indictment on the rest of the continent, but I think it's deserved that these two specific teams are in this Champions League final. I don't think the Premier League is heads and shoulders above the rest of the top five leagues or the rest of the leagues in Europe at all, really. I think they have a lot of talent, but there are some poorly run clubs towards the top of the Premier League, just as there are in La Liga or in any league. Take your pick in Europe right now. Man City and Chelsea are both excellent. They're coached by excellent coaches. They have tons of talent. They spent a bajillion dollars, pounds. They spent so much money to build these teams, as have other teams in Europe. But they have the talent, they have the skill, they have the execution to get to this point. And there's also something to be said for the fact that the Champions League, just like the World Cup or any knockout tournament, is a little bit random at times, is a little bit, it does rely on luck in specific moments. You have to get a little bit fortunate to get there. But all of that said, the two teams that are in the final, I think, deserve to be in the final. But the rest of Europe is certainly no slackers either. There's talent there, and I don't think the Premier League is heads and shoulders above the rest based off of these two teams making the final.
What a diplomatic answer, Joe. I like that. Very balanced. Thank you very much. Graham, it's Joe's favourite part of the show. It's prediction time. I think
yes,
when Chelsea...
bring it.
Yeah, there is documented evidence on this very podcast of when Chelsea beat Porto, and I said, Chelsea are just going to win this whole thing. And I wish I put money on it at that point, because I'm not sure my thought has changed on that. I feel like this is 2012 again. What do you think, Graham?
I just look at that City squad and just think they are really, really good. I mean, yesterday, PSG, Pierre Pochettino only has, you know, Mitchell Bakker, and Moise Keane's not bad, and Danilo Pereira is a decent player, but Julian Draxler, who's not the player he was a few years ago, they're the sort of players he's bringing off the bench, and then Pep's bringing on Sterling, Aguero, Jesus, and then the players he didn't bring on were Laporte, Mendy, Ake, Cancelo, Ferran Torres, Rodri. I mean, it's just a little bit ridiculous, to be honest. I just feel like, I know Chelsea beat City in the FA Cup semi-final a few weeks ago, but City weirdly rested a few games for few players for that game. So I just feel like once they get their strongest 11 on the pitch, I think City will just be too strong.
It's a good point, but City have been strong in previous years as well. We've, you know, they've been pretty darn good and still not quite made it on the European stage. That still makes me think Chelsea might get this done. Joe, your prediction, everybody's waiting for it with bated breath.
Okay, so here's my thought process here, folks. I think if I pick Man City and they win, you know, oh, you picked Man City, everybody picked Man City. If I pick Chelsea and they win, then it's a little bit of the underdog's pick, and I look better for backing the American who is most likely to play. So, Ryan, I'm going to follow in your footsteps. I don't know if our reasoning was similar at all. I suspect it's not. But I'm going to say Chelsea's going to win this whole darn thing. Do I actually believe that? Who knows, man? But it's going to be a fun game, and I am genuinely excited for it.
Basically, it's going to be a case of, is Tuchel Avram Grant, or is he Roberto Di Matteo in this final?
Oh, wow. What a choice. I guess he wants to be Roberto, but we shall see, Graham.
Everybody shall see.
indeed. Well, given that choice, I suppose you're right. We're going to come back after these short messages with some CONCACAF action.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Total Soccer Show, we are back. We are talking CONCACAF Champions League and the quarterfinal stage in particular. We had some second legs going on Tuesday evening, some other second legs going on Wednesday evening. Just a little, they've missed our recording time, unfortunately, but we're going to talk about a couple of games from Tuesday. Starting off, Joe, with Philadelphia taking on Atlanta United. This one finishing 1-1 on the night, 4-1 on aggregate. Philly with the 3-0 lead from the first leg. When we talked about this one last week, Joe, it was a story of Atlanta being very good despite getting a 3-0 pounding. How did that balance look in this game?
It kind of flip-flopped. Well, first of all, you know, boo on CONCACAF for not scheduling their games around our recording times. That's extremely disrespectful.
I know, right?
It's their loss. It's everyone's loss, really. The game kind of flip-flopped. In the first leg, as you said, Ryan, I thought Atlanta were very good. They were really fun, super fluid in possession, but using that fluidity to actually create some chances in the first 45 minutes, and then they come out and get blitzed a little bit in the second half on the counter. In this game, Atlanta have a ton of the ball because they have to break the Union down because they need three goals to extend this game and have a chance to win this tie. But they can't break the Union down. The Union defended really well in that 4-4-2 diamond, and Atlanta United looked a little bit lost trying to pull players out. They get a goal right before halftime thanks to a moment of absolute class from Santiago Sosa, their new number 6 / center back / legend. But
he does it all, doesn't he?
He does. He genuinely does. And it's a bit of a microcosm for how Heinze wants to play. It's you move here, then you move here. And the defense says, whoa, he just moved from there to there. I was not expecting that. And you multiply that by 10 for the outfield players and you get the idea. It is total football-esque. Johan Cruyff, I think, would genuinely be a little bit proud. But Atlanta still have had lots of lapses between understanding that they need to be fluid and Heinze wants them to be fluid, but also figuring out how to transition from being fluid to actually creating chances. In all of their games under Gabriel Heinze this year, they've only scored more than one goal in one of those games, and that was against the Chicago Fire, who are super leaky defensively. They are error-prone, to say the least, in Major League Soccer. And so I'm not hugely surprised that Atlanta couldn't continue their momentum from the first 45 minutes of the last leg, but they needed to do that, and they couldn't.
Do we need to worry at all about Atlanta's defending, Joe? I think one of my takeaways is it looked quite curious at some points and vulnerable at set pieces.
Yes and no. Yes, because I think there are individual defensive errors that could be improved. I'm actually thinking more of the last leg with Alan Franco, their designated player center back, who was kind of all over the place. It was his first game, to be fair. But in this game, I guess I'm less concerned with the individual errors and more thinking that some of the defensive problems were just a factor of how the game had to be played. Atlanta needed to push numbers forward. They needed to create chances. As it turns out, they couldn't, but by pushing numbers into the attack, you then leave yourself vulnerable for space with space in behind or in between your lines or whatever the situation is. The Union are so dangerous attacking in transition. They have been over the last couple of years under Jim Curtin, and they will break through you. They will score goals, and as it turns out, they did towards the end of this game. I don't think that's a huge issue for Atlanta overall, though. I think that's more of just a situation that was specific to this particular match.
Yeah, quite a lot of Atlanta shirts in the six-yard box, nowhere near Kasper Schmeichel when he did get that late goal. I couldn't help but notice. Graham, were you able to watch this one in the UK?
Not live. There's still not a broadcast deal in the UK for the CONCACAF Champions League, but I did manage to catch the highlights. And Sosa was the player who naturally caught my eye, obviously, with the goal. I, to my shame, haven't seen much of him a bit before he moved to MLS. So I wasn't entirely sure what to expect of him. And from what I'd read of him, I was watching that goal, I'm a little bit like, and why is he out in that position scoring from there? and then Matthew Doyle's kind of analysis for MLSsoccer.com was he was focusing on Sosa and basically echoed what you guys were saying, which is he is a guy for every job. So I'm very much looking forward to watching him in MLS this season.
To your shame, Graham, that you haven't seen much of him before he came to Atlanta, you watch a lot of soccer. You don't have to feel shame that you don't get to watch River Plate and all that.
The thing is, I probably have. I've watched like River Plate and Libertadores and stuff like that, but I can't recall having seen him. So, yeah, that's shameful.
Fair enough. Well, I think a highlight for me was the sideline scrap with Jim Curtin in his hoodie, having some pretty heated words with Gabriel Hinser in this one, Joe.
it was a nice little. It wasn't a scrap. It wasn't a dust off, but it was a disagreement, certainly a mincing of words, a clashing of words between those two coaches. I think it all stemmed from Jim Curtin apparently not getting Sergio Santos off the field fast enough in the second half after he went down with a quote-unquote cramp. It might have been a cramp. It might not have been. I don't know, and it doesn't really matter. But Hinze wanted that to all happen faster so his team could have a better chance to actually come back in this game. And afterwards, they had a little meeting. They had a nice little long conversation. I didn't catch the end of it, but I don't think there was any shaking of hands that happened. And Jim Curtin had some nice, edgy post-match comments. And man, I just don't think there's a way to spin this that's not entertaining, one, and also just good for Major League Soccer. So I'm 100% here for more coaching beefs across the league. Just pencil my name down on that petition.
Yeah, we will. It's tough to be edgy in a sky blue hoodie, I think.
It is, but Jim Curtin can do it, man. Jim Curtin can do it.
Can indeed. And Philadelphia Union can certainly do it. They are in the semifinals of the Champions League for the first time in their history. They will face either the Portland Timbers or Club America. As a listener, you may know by the result of that game by the time you listen to this one. Why don't we talk about the other game from Tuesday evening? Cruz Azul against Toronto. The Aztec are never an easy place to go, whether they're fans or not. This one finishing 1-0 to Cruz Azul. 4-1 on aggregate to the Mexican side as well, who are in very good form, who are leading the Clausura stage of Liga MX at the moment as well. And Toronto without a few big names as well, Joe, seemed like it was never going to go their way this one.
It really wasn't. And they didn't cause Cruz Azul a ton of trouble. I loved on the broadcast, before I talk a little bit more about Toronto, on the Fox broadcast, they had a little infographic talking about the first leg of this tie was played at Raymond James Stadium in Tampa Bay, which is basically at sea level. I think it's 36 feet above sea level. And then Estadio Azteca is 7,000 plus feet above sea level. Just the difference in elevation, I think, is fascinating in some weird way. And I don't know if that played any factor here. But Toronto struggled to break Cruz Azul down, which is kind of understandable. They're missing Pozuelo still. They're missing their new signing, who's not expected to be a part of this game at all. But still, Jefferson Soltado, who's a very highly rated player coming from the Brazilian league, they're missing pieces right now. No Jose Altidore, who you can never really count on at this point in his career to actually be available and fit. But Toronto didn't create a ton of chances. They tried to play direct over Cruz Azul, and that didn't pay off a lot. And they didn't give up a ton of chances either. The goal that Tenorio scores for Cruz Azul was an absolute banger. But it comes from a bit of direct play that Toronto can't take in any advantage out of. It comes from balls in midfield that they can't truly win and settle and then attack on their own. Toronto didn't look bad in this game, but they certainly didn't look all that good either.
Yeah, that was a banger as well. Graham, did you see that goal? It reminded me a lot of sort of peak Zlatan, that goal from Brian Angulo.
Yep, a banger is definitely how to describe that goal. From the highlights, just to switch a little bit to TFC, it just felt like from the highlights they were quite manic in their play from the start, and understandable they wanted to play with quite a bit of urgency, but just felt like everything was a little bit rushed. And I know RMS wants to implement a high press style, but as Joe mentions there, it just feels like the pieces aren't in place for them to do that. But I am interested to see where TFC go from this point, especially with Soteldo, the new DP coming in. But just when you were mentioning Raymond James Stadium there, sorry to completely shift focus there. Is the weekend still locked in the scoreboard at Raymond James Stadium in Tampa, trying to find his way out?
I think he might be just trapped in there from the Super Bowl. Yeah, I don't think he's been allowed to leave or has chosen to leave. I'm not sure which it is.
Yeah.
Poor guy. Still wandering those lit hallways somewhere back there underneath the pirate ship or something, I imagine. Poor guy.
I do. Sorry, Ryan. I just wanted to say, Graham, you talking about what Chris Armas is trying to do and the fact that they're still missing players. My biggest takeaway from this game is I'm still so curious to see what Toronto are going to look like when they are as close to fully healthy as they're going to get. You get Pozuelo, you get Soltado. I mean, how is this team going to look? Does Chris Armas still high press, even though they don't have the center back talent to really play the high line? They don't have the speed. They get Chris Mavinga back for the first 45 minutes of this game, which is good. He's their best center back by a mile. They're reported for an Argentinian center back, but I don't think that guy's all that mobile from what I've read and heard from people either. So I'm just curious, is this team going to press high and play that high line, or are they going to try to use the ball more? Because they're going to have the attacking talent to break teams down, at least in Major League Soccer. I just am really curious to see how Chris Armas is going to continue to evolve his tactics or how he's going to continue to set up this team going forward.
Well, that was going to be my follow-up question, Joe, because do we have to worry about Toronto a little bit this season? I mean, not the best start to the domestic campaign. Was it 6 goals conceded in the first 2 games already? Looks like there's a bit of frailty, and we can give them dispensation for not having a full-strength squad at the moment, but do we need to worry?
A little bit. I think, yeah, I do think a little worry is warranted. They don't have defensive talent, really. They are getting Kamar Lawrence, reportedly, by The Athletic. It looks like they're going to be bringing him back and have their back to Major League Soccer and have him be their de facto left back, which I think will help. He's a very talented player. But I don't think they have center back talent. I've said it before, I'll say it again. They struggle to defend on set pieces, or at least they have so far this year. I am concerned about their ability to defend. I am not as concerned about their ability to score goals. I think they're going to be hugely entertaining with Pozuelo and with Soltado, with Ayo Akinola or whoever's playing up top. Noble Akello maybe getting some minutes off the bench, young Canadian talent. They have some really fun players to watch. Richie Larea, Delgado, Michael Bradley, Jonathan Osorio. I'm not concerned about them with the ball yet, but I am a little bit concerned about their ability to play without the ball, which is important when Chris Armas is your head coach.
Indeed. Well, they've got an opportunity to catch a W when they face the Red Bulls this weekend. We shall see. I think that just about wraps it up for this show, gents. Thank you very much for joining me on this intrepid journey through 2 brands of Champions League. Graham, is there anything more you'd like to leave your mark on this wonderful recording before we head off?
Nope. I think we have covered everything over 2 confederations, 8 teams, everything. I think we covered it all.
We did indeed. You'd be very proud of yourself, Graham. Thank you very much for joining us once again. We do appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Catch you next time.
That sounded unnecessarily condescending, by the way. I'm sorry. Joe, pleasure as always. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Ryan.
Bye.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.